From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. And we're learning today about the worst disaster in U.S. naval history. The Navy cruiser Indianapolis is remembered for a cataclysmic loss of life. This was after being downed by Japanese torpedoes in July of 1945. Nearly 900 men abandoned ship and were prey to sharks for a harrowing 5 days at sea. Here remembered by the weathered character Quint, played by Robert Shaw in the movie Jaws.
Lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then... oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces.
The true story of that tragedy and the court-martial of the captain that followed is covered in thorough and sometimes excruciating detail by Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek in their book Indianapolis. After days at sea, their skin burned, their tongues swelled with dehydration, many people just begin losing their minds. And some fantasize that if they got back to the ship, they'd find food and safety out of the water. It's harrowing to read about these men so connected and united in their duty on board Indy, now desperate and calculating the best way to kill a man if they became violent. How did they talk to you about these hours and days of despair?
Well, many of the stories that were expressed were kept between these men until very close to the end of their lives. They realized that if they had not shared these stories, or if they do not share these stories, no one would ever know once they're gone. And so they had asked me initially when I started interviewing the survivors, you know, they'd said, oh, don't tell anyone this, don't share this, it's too much, or it paints a bad picture of someone, you know, because we all want to think of everyone as heroes, but, you know, the truth is we're human and everyone wants to survive, and people may not have done the best things in order to survive. And so, you know, but as these survivors got toward the very end of their lives, they said, no, we really want you to tell the whole story. We want people to know what took place. And, you know, that was a lot of really hard things to tell and to do it respectfully. And we didn't want to use real names. I'm sorry, we didn't use any names when we were telling the stories of those who, you know, may have done things that were not heroic, but were done in order to preserve their lives or their best friends' lives. And so we tried to tell those stories amidst the shark attacks and the dehydration and the fights that went on. Just in, you know, it really was a tale of human survival and in the best and the worst light.
So one of the shark stories that stands out is a young man, 19 years old, named L.D. Cox. And he saw a man next to him get snatched by a shark. And it was so close that the attack caused a wave to break over him, just like he was at the beach. And when he looked, his friend was gone. A second attack that's very vivid to me was a man named Eugene Morgan. He was looking at one of the floater nets that Sarah mentioned, and there were about a dozen men on the floater net. And all of a sudden, it was attacked by something like 10 or 15 sharks. And it was a frenzy of froth and foam and fins. And then within less than a minute, the entire net and all the men on it were gone.
Mm. It is just harrowing. And after days at sea, many of them were burned when they got on. Some of those survived, but sunburned, tongues swollen with dehydration, and they really began losing their minds. Sarah, you referred to some of the depravity, but how did they describe it?
These men were doing whatever they could for the greater good. And these were their brothers. And these decisions were not taken lightly. I mean, it affected the men who teamed together. And, you know, to take a step back and give you a little bit more on that story, you know, men had lost their minds by this point. They were totally hallucinating and their, you know, brain swelling, they're drinking salt water, they're close to death, and they're just taking out people around them. A lot of it is because, remember, they're covered in oil and they're confused. So they're now thinking these are Japanese people attacking them. So they're trying to fight back. They're not in their right mind. And you know, these men that are hallucinating are taking out men that are healthy or as healthy as you can be at that point in the water. And so the group of individuals who decided to team up and say, if anyone starts attacking anyone else, we'll take them out first. They agonized over this decision and it affected them the rest of their lives. I mean, you know, two of them took their own lives not long after surviving. And so it was something that was done for the greater good, but at even the cost of part of, I think, their souls, because it was just so devastating to have to do that to a shipmate that you thought so highly of.
I just found myself screaming, why did no one at Sinkpack know that Indy had been sunk? Why?
It's a multitude of reasons, and sadly, one of the biggest reasons was complacency. As I mentioned before, the southern part of the Pacific, the South Pacific, Philippine Sea, was considered safe. At least it was considered safe by those who weren't paying attention. Those who were paying attention did know that there was an enemy submarine threat, a Japanese submarine threat, but that information was kept, paradoxically, on the highest levels of classification. So in addition to complacency, what you had was a failure to communicate. So you had a failure to communicate the submarine threat on the western half of the Philippine Sea with the commanders on the eastern half at Guam. And those people failed to communicate a threat to Captain McVeigh. And in addition to that, it was later considered a failure that there was no escort sent. So in addition to those lacks of communication, as Sarah mentioned, all the communications were out aboard Indianapolis. So even though there were heroic radio men in the radio rooms trying to send out distress signals, those distress signals did not reach shore. And then in addition to complacency and a lack of communication, there was also incompetence. There was a lieutenant named Stuart Gibson who was in the arrivals office in the Philippines, and he had received a message that said not to report the arrival of combatant ships. The reason for that instruction was to cut down on routine message traffic. And he thought to himself, well, gee, if I'm not supposed to report the arrival of combatant ships, I guess I'm not supposed to report the non-arrival of combatant ships. Mm. And he was later disciplined for that, although it was a slap on the wrist compared to what happened to Captain McVeigh.
Right. We'll definitely want to know more about that. But first, let's get to the beautiful part that they were indeed saved. Nearly 600 men died in those 5 days, it sounds like. They were discovered 5 days later, almost by chance. So what happened there?
Actually, the rescue part of the story is really one of our favorite parts of the story. Lieutenant Gwynn was flying routine patrol, and he was testing out a new antenna, and the antenna had broke off, and so he had gone back to check it out, and when he opened up the doors and he looked down, he saw an oil slick. And, you know, they're way, way up. There's no way they could see people in the water at this point, but he saw the oil slick, and he thought it was a submarine. And so he, you know, orders his co-pilot to dive down. They're going to open the bomb bay doors. And just as they're opening the bomb bay doors, they look and they see heads in the water. And we don't know who this is. You know, we don't know if it's enemy. We don't know if it's our own. There's no reports of major losses. And so he doesn't know what's going on. He calls it in, ducks on the pond, and he starts circling, and he's seeing more and more men in the water, and they're spread out over something like 25 miles at this point because, you know, the ones on the rafts had drifted further than the men in the water that were swimming. And so they're spread out in different groups. They're not even aware of each other. You know, the survivors at this point don't even know that there are others in the water other than the ones close to them. And so Chuck Gwynn spots these men, calls it in, and all of a sudden, you know, other pilots start arriving. And I think Lynn really wants to tell you the Adrian Mark story, so I'm going to toss the baton over to her on this.
The reason I really want to tell you the Adrian Mark story is because when I was in the Navy, I was in the aviation community. And this man, Adrian Marks, was the pilot of a Catalina, which is a seaplane. And I think he is just one of the absolute heroes of this story. Adrian Marks is one of the pilots that flies up in response to Lieutenant Gwynn's distress sighting message. And once he is there, he is just astonished at the scope of the disaster that he can see unfurling underneath him. He sees hundreds of men in the water. And by this time, Lieutenant Gwynn, another aircraft that had come to the scene, and Marks' own crew had kicked out all the rescue gear that they had. So they had, you know, water casks, and they had rafts, and they had portable radios that they hoped that they could dump into the water and that people would understand how to use them. But now the sun is going down, and everyone knows, all the aviators know, that no rescue ships will arrive in the area for at least 12 hours. Well, it's against regulations and against policy for Marks to land his seaplane in the open sea. The swells are 12 feet high. A seaplane can land in the sea. That's its purpose. But it's supposed to be like in a smoother area. And so that's why those landings in the open sea were both dangerous and forbidden. And as Marks is looking down and considering that, his crew looks down and they can see men still being taken by sharks. And he decides, you know what? The rules be damned. I'm in a position to save some of these men, and I'm going to make an open sea landing. And so he lands that plane successfully in the water, and he starts to water taxi around, and they're able to crowd 53 survivors onto his plane while they're waiting for the actual surface ships to show up.
We are learning this hour about the terrible end of the Indianapolis. It was the worst naval disaster in U.S. history, with Sarah Vladeck, who's become an authority on the Navy cruiser. She's made a documentary film about it and is now co-writer of the book Indianapolis with Lynn Vincent, a former investigative journalist and a Navy veteran. The wreckage was discovered in 2017. This was 72 years after it was sunk by the Japanese, just weeks before surrender. There are many stories of heroism here and survival, along with retribution for commanding officer Captain Charles McVeigh, who was court-martialed. What happened?
So the Navy went through a process of looking at what they could charge Captain McVeigh with. And what that came down to was the failure to call abandoned ship, which they very quickly proved that he did. There was multiple testimonies given during the court of inquiry and in the court-martial showing that he gave the order and that it was passed verbally from sailor to sailor. And then the second charge they brought up against him was failure to zigzag. And what zigzagging was a maneuver used at that time to evade Japanese or enemy submarine torpedoes. Well, by that point in the war, this was common practice. The Japanese actually factored this into their maneuvers so that they would, you know, accommodate for the zigzagging. In fact, Hashimoto had even planned with that in mind. And so during this court-martial, what happened is they bring in, you know, for the first time ever, they bring in the enemy to testify against Captain McVeigh. You know, this was not done prior to this. Actually, a captain had never been brought in for court-martial for the loss of a vessel during wartime prior to this either. So, you know, this was all something set up to point a finger because you had 879 families who wanted someone to blame. And this was very much in the press. It was, you know, national news, what was going on with this court-martial. And they bring in Commander Hashimoto to testify against Captain McVeigh. And what Hashimoto said through a translator was that he would have sunk the ship no matter what. But that's not what the translator conveyed. And Hashimoto, not speaking English, he understood, but he couldn't convey properly that that's not what he said. And so the failure to zigzag was really kind of a bogus charge because it wouldn't have mattered. He would have been able to sunk the ship no matter what.
And an accelerated trial to get him to court-martial. Mm-hmm. What did happen to him?
Captain McVeigh First of all, after his conviction, which ruined his career, he was sent to a staff job. He would never again be in command, and he retired in 1949, 4 years after his court-martial. And then he went into insurance, and it was very sad, you know, because he was the commander of this proud flagship and had a distinguished career prior to taking command of Indianapolis. And instead of staying, you know, in touch with his fellow officers and joining fraternities as men did at that time when they were retired, he just faded into the background. And the saddest thing was is that not all of the Indianapolis families blamed Captain McVeigh for the loss of their sons and brothers and husbands, but many did. And the fact that they did was directly attributable to the fact that the Navy said it was his fault. They convicted him. And so for many, many years after the court-martial, Captain McVeigh would receive these terrible letters from families of the lost that said things like, if it wasn't for you, I'd be celebrating Christmas with my husband right now, or if it wasn't for you, my girls would have a father. And these letters seemed penned in acid, and they came on birthdays of the lost, on the anniversary of the sinking, and they never stopped. And for many, many years, he received them. In 1960, the Indianapolis survivors held their first reunion, and Captain McVeigh was invited as the keynote speaker. And one of the wonderful parts of the story we find is that the men still supported him after all those years. However, the letters never stopped coming, and in 1968, it became too much, and Captain McVeigh committed suicide.
It was just one tragedy on top of several others in this story. But for you, those survivors, those who first started meeting in 1960 at a reunion, Sarah, you said 17 years with these people, and for both of you, a race against the clock, really, to talk with these survivors. How many are alive now?
Absolutely. I mean, when I started, there were 117 survivors alive, and now there are 14 still living. And the youngest is going to be 92.
Oh.
So, you know, you're right. It's coming to an end. And every time it's like losing a grandpa. So, you know, it's been such a treasure and such a blessing to get to share their lives, you know, parts of their lives with them and their families and become so close to them. But it's also really, really hard to go to 117 memorial services.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. But, you know, I'm wondering about how they feel about their story now being told. Lynn, you're a Navy veteran. What does it mean for you to see these men and really their families suddenly have this story exposed?
Well, I'm welling up a little bit as you ask that question, because there are, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands and millions, if you look back through history, of men and, of course, more recently, women who have done this heroic service. And it's a very quiet heroism. There's not a lot of fanfare. You know, most people who serve in the military, they don't get a parade when they come home. And so to be able to tell these stories, just the ordinary story of the ordinary sailor or the ordinary officer, to just show how they were able to serve their country and many of them to make the ultimate sacrifice, is just so meaningful to me and to the larger military community. It's been a real honor.
Well, I am so grateful that you shared this story with us. And I want to let listeners know that, you know, this is a deep story, but there's so much more. There is, as you say in the title, the fight to exonerate an innocent man. And there's this whole relationship and after story with Hashimoto that is just fascinating. So I will leave that to them, as I thank you so much, Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent, for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent will be at the upcoming Savannah Book Festival to talk about their book, Indianapolis. And we'll have a crew there from On Second Thought as well. Hope to see you there. And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, with two authors featured at the upcoming Savannah Book Festival. Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent co-wrote Indianapolis, and we're learning today about the final days of that storied naval cruiser that was sunk by Japanese torpedoes in the final days of World War II. The attack came weeks after delivering nuclear material and components of the first atomic bomb to Tinian Island, that's in the Mariana Archipelago. It was the launching point for the U.S. attack on Hiroshima.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
That is President Harry Truman announcing the result to the nation.
We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake, we shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
To pick up the story, the Indy hobbled back eventually to Mare Island off the coast of California. Men were given leave, but then called back for a mysterious, highly secretive mission. The moral questions of the use of the atomic bomb to force Japanese surrender have been thoroughly debated ever since. But could you give us your read on this decision that was made by Truman just months into his presidency?
It's really interesting. When we first set out to write this piece, we thought, oh gosh, there are all these moral questions swirling around the use of both atomic bombs on Japanese cities. And the way we decided to handle it is to show the struggle that took place at the time. So even the scientist who first came up with the nuclear fission chain theory and urged, along with Albert Einstein, urged the United States to develop an atomic weapon, even though he was the one that came up with the idea, he later petitioned the government and said, no, it would be immoral to drop these kinds of weapons on the Japanese people. Even Admiral Nimitz, the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, opposed using the bomb up until the very end. Truman himself also struggled with the moral questions. And so what it came down to was, how many lives will be lost in a homeland island invasion of Japan versus how many will be lost if we drop these bombs? And in the end, the numbers came out to be, you know, tens of thousands of lives lost if the bombs were used, versus up to a million lives lost in a home island invasion. And so those were the moral questions that were wrestled through. And eventually, because of the Japanese demonstrating that they would never, never surrender, that was the decision that Truman made to drop the bomb. And of course, he dropped, the Army Air Force dropped one on August 6th, 1945, and one on August 9th, 1945. And then the surrender happened on August 15th, 1945.
When the decision was made to carry these parts of the bomb to Tinian, which is in the Mariana Islands, who knew that it was on board the Indianapolis?
So there were two men who knew that the bomb components were being transferred, and that was James Nolan and Robert Furman. And these men were part of the Manhattan Project and had been selected by Leslie Groves exactly for that reason, to make sure that the cargo was carried safely, that if the ship was lost, it would be, you know, if there was one thing saved and the ship was lost, it would be the components of the bomb. Because we didn't have enough of the uranium to build another bomb quickly enough if it was lost. So it would have taken another, was it 6 to 8 months or something of, you know, something along those lines in order to gather enough uranium to build another bomb.
So Captain McVeigh didn't even know that this was on board a ship, or he didn't know what it was.
He didn't know what it was. He had some guesses, but, you know, it was never confirmed nor denied. No one told him, but he did not know. He was not read into the mission.
And the crew also had their suspicions of what it was. It was, some of the theories were very interesting.
Oh, yes. The crew, I mean, remember, these, again, for the most part, these are really young men, some teenagers. And so they made bets on what this cargo was. Everything from Rita Hayworth's undergarments, you know, because she'd be appearing at the USO shows, or it would be, you know, toilet paper for General MacArthur. And so you can imagine they know this thing is something important, but they don't know what.
So there wasn't a lot of great regard for General MacArthur in general on board this ship. But how about Captain McVeigh? Can you give us a little sense of his relationship with the crew and with the officers on board? This is a man from a line of Navy officers.
Captain McVeigh was a sailor's man. The crew loved him. He was fairly new to the ship. He had come aboard in November of 1944 as the new captain. And, you know, the men were getting used to him as the new commander of their vessel, but he really spent time with the enlisted men. You know, he wasn't just an officer's guy. He would go down into the galley and make sure that the men were getting good food, where, you know, most officers wouldn't spend the time doing that at the time. So, you know, he cared about these men and they cared about him. And it really showed up later, you know, when it came to, you know, I won't give the spoiler away, but when it came time to defend their captain, there wasn't a single man who didn't stand behind him.
Mm-hmm. So then they dropped this off. It's a kind of a comical description of there was a kind of elaborate decoy, a big crate that was moved out. And then these two gentlemen, Robert Furman and James Nolan, carrying these components of the atomic bomb out in what, canisters or something like that?
Yes, they were. Two canisters that were described as looking like old-fashioned ice cream freezers, but the one canister that had the actual uranium in it was very, very heavy because at that time, uranium was the densest and heaviest of natural elements. And so what they had to do was thread a pole through eye bolts that were screwed into the top of the canisters and have sailors carry the pole on top of their shoulders with the two canisters dangling off each end.
Well, so they look like headhunters.
Yes, exactly.
In some old cartoon or something like that. Carrying this, you know, after sitting with it, sleeping next to these components of the atomic bomb, and we, of course, know what happened then. But they dropped this off, and then they were supposed to go to Guam for what McVeigh hoped would be training for the crew, some of which was pretty green. Why did they not have an escort?
They didn't have an escort because at that time, the southern Philippine Sea was considered safe. Indianapolis was supposed to next go from Guam to the Philippines, and that is almost a straight westbound shot over the great vast expanse of the South Pacific. And at that time, the Navy considered that part of the ocean safe. Not only that, but the escort, the destroyer escorts, and for listeners who aren't familiar with what an escort was, ships like cruisers and other capital ships, not all of them had underwater sound detection, and so they would be escorted by a destroyer or a destroyer escort, which is a different kind of ship, so that those smaller, faster, more agile ships with sound detection equipment could keep an eye out for submarines. And by this time, you know, we're getting very close to the end of the war, and a lot of the destroyer escort fleet had been beaten up pretty well. They were in for repairs, and most of the war was taking place now in the northern Pacific, and so that was the priority area for escort ships. So with that being the case and the southern Philippine Sea being considered more safe, they decided that Indianapolis did not need an escort to sail from Guam to the Philippines.
So this is kind of an incredible thing about this book and this story that, you know, this ultra top secret mission is completed. And then, you know, this whole chain of events gets set off. An elaborate cat and mouse game with the Indianapolis and this Japanese sub. And this is led by a man named Machitsura Hashimoto. Can I get a little background on his character and his strategy?
Well, he had been commanding submarines back to Pearl Harbor. You know, he was there for that attack. And so he had watched, well, depending on what side you're on, but unfortunately for the Japanese, the submarine program had been quite a huge failure. And so, you know, now we're bringing in these Kaiten, which are essentially kamikaze submarines. You know, the men would be strapped to these submarines that, you know, they could only be sent off to hit a target and they could not return. So they were suicide vessels. And Hashimoto really didn't, he wasn't an advocate of using them. He would use them if he had to. And so this was part of the strategy, however, that they were, you know, ordered to use these Kaiten. And these Kaiten pilots were very eager to serve and die for their emperor. And so they wanted to be used. And in this situation with the Indianapolis, you know, they came up at midnight. It was a cloud-covered night. And when they surfaced, the clouds parted and the light shone on the ship, and it was right in their path. And so Hashimoto could have used the Kaitens, but he knew that he could aim, fire, and hit the Indianapolis and wouldn't need those Kaitens. So he opted to not use them, much to their dismay, and fired, we believe it's 6 torpedoes, 2 of which actually made contact with Indianapolis.
My guests Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent will be at the Savannah Book Festival this month, and we're learning about the ship Indianapolis. Their book's subtitle is The True Story of the Worst Sea Disaster in U.S. Naval History and the 50-Year Fight to Exonerate an Innocent Man.
It is just breathtaking what happens. With such detail, you tell us about that night, July 30th, 1945, when Hashimoto's submarine finally got a clear shot. The bow of the Indy is hanging on by a sliver. How long did it take to go down?
It only took 12 minutes from the time of impact until the ship had entirely disappeared. It was 12 minutes. So, you know, we've been talking longer than that to give you an idea. It was very quick, and the ship had lost power almost instantly. And so there was not light. There was not, you know, I mean, there were battle lanterns, but it was a moon-covered night. So it was very, very dark. It was pitch black on the bridge. There was no ability to convey or project sound across the ship. So anything that had, you know, orders that were given were, you know, voice to voice, man to man. And these men, you know, were woken up. Most of them had just gone to sleep because it was just after midnight and they'd gotten off their shift. And they were just laying down to go to sleep and the torpedoes hit. And so they were, you know, somewhat disoriented. What was really interesting to me, one of the survivors by the name of Jim Jarvis talked about what woke him up was not the torpedo hit, but the fact that everything went silent on the ship. So all these motors, all these, you know, the ventilation system, all these different things that were running that always had a constant hum went silent. And that's what woke him up. And so, you know, and then it was kind of an ordered chaos from what we were told, where men knew what they were supposed to do. But, you know, you also have everything below decks filling with water very quickly. The, you know, they were not receiving any word from the bridge to the engine rooms to tell them to cut off power to stop the propellers. And so the ship is pushing forward as the bow is torn off. It's just taking water in and it's going throughout all the various compartments of the ship. And she's sinking fast. And, you know, she's listing eventually to, you know, 45 degree angle where men can't even stand on the decks. And then she starts going down by the head.
It is amazing for me to read the presence of mind that they had, you know, getting fire hoses, trying to seal off steam room, engine rooms. And this is all done in the dark with no communication because the communication is down. Everything to save the ship. And they're just incredible details here. And you note in the book that men were forbidden from keeping journals in case they fell into the wrong hands. So how did you assemble all of these details?
We were so fortunate, number one, to have the first-person accounts that Sarah gathered up over those. By the time we got started, it had been 13, 14 years. So we had those things. We also had damage reports that were official from people who had survived and then written official accounts for the Navy. In addition to that, people had self-published memoirs, or some men, particularly one man named Glenn Morgan, who was a bugler on the ship. He had written multiple handwritten accounts of exactly what happened moment by moment. So we were able to collect all of these details and really, sort of like a filmmaker with a camera, try to focus in on different parts of the ship at different times and what different sailors and officers were experiencing, moment by moment to give that really detailed account of what happened. One document that we got at the really the last minute was the transcript of the Court of Inquiry that was held in on August 13th, 1945 at Guam immediately after the survivors were rescued. And that shed a lot of light that we didn't have before on exactly what happened in those final moments.
Mm, but a lot had happened in between that, which we will get to certainly. But first, how many escaped once McVeigh did give the orders to abandon ship, knowing that some jumped before?
We estimate that about 300 men went down with the ship, and so that would leave something under 900 to make it into the water alive. And when I say alive, you know, that's sort of a relative term because some men died very quickly, even within the first hour. Mm. But we do estimate that there were something around 600 in the, what would you say, Sarah? Well, several hundred remained alive throughout those 5 days.
And they splintered into different groups. How many rafts did they have?
We believe that there were 12 rafts actually aboard or that made it off the ship. But also you have to remember, people started abandoning ship very soon after the torpedo hit, all the way until she sank. And so this was about a mile that they were spread out over, during, you know, for which that time. Also, those who abandoned ship on the low side were more likely to have supplies as they slid off the ship into the water. But, you know, protocol is that you're supposed to abandon ship on the high side. And that's where the majority of the men actually did abandon ship. And so there were no supplies. So these were the men that were in the water just swimming. Mm. And they had nothing. Some of them didn't even have life jackets at the beginning. And then the groups that went down on the low side, they had a couple of their rafts, but there was really only about 30 men on the rafts. The rest were either in life jackets, just swimming, or on floater nets.
Floater nets meaning?
Yeah, so floater nets were these large, like 15 square foot nets about that had pieces of cork every few feet that would keep them above water. So the men would, you know, be spread out on these or holding onto the edge of these nets to stay, you know, afloat as best they could.
Sarah Vladeck and Lynn Vincent are authors of a book about the downing of the Navy cruiser Indianapolis. When we come back, the perilous days that followed when hundreds of men succumbed to hunger, injuries, and sharks. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. And we're learning today about the worst disaster in U.S. naval history. The Navy cruiser Indianapolis is remembered for a cataclysmic loss of life. This was after being downed by Japanese torpedoes in July of 1945. Nearly 900 men abandoned ship and were prey to sharks for a harrowing 5 days at sea. Here remembered by the weathered character Quint, played by Robert Shaw in the movie Jaws.
Lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in, they rip you to pieces.
The true story of that tragedy and the court-martial of the captain that followed is covered in thorough and sometimes excruciating detail by Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladeck in their book Indianapolis. After days at sea, their skin burned, their tongues swelled with dehydration, many people just begin losing their minds, and some fantasize that if they got back to the ship, they'd find food and safety out of the water. It's harrowing to read about these men so connected and united in their duty on board Indy, now desperate and calculating the best way to kill a man if they became violent. How did they talk to you about these hours and days of despair?
Well, many of the stories that were expressed were kept between these men until very close to the end of their lives. They realized that if they had not shared these stories, or if they do not share these stories, no one would ever know once they're gone. And so they had asked me initially when I started interviewing the survivors, you know, they'd said, oh, don't tell anyone this, don't share this, it's too much, or it paints a bad picture of someone, you know, because we all want to think of everyone as heroes, but, you know, the truth is we're human and everyone wants to survive, and people may not have done the best things in order to survive. And so, you know, but as these survivors got toward the very end of their lives, they said, no, we really want you to tell the whole story. We want people to know what took place. And, you know, that was a lot of really hard things to tell and to do it respectfully. And we didn't want to use real names. I'm sorry, we didn't use any names when we were telling the stories of those who, you know, may have done things that were not heroic, but were done in order to preserve their lives or their best friend's lives. And so we tried to tell those stories amidst the shark attacks and the dehydration and the fights that went on. Just in, you know, it really was a tale of human survival and in the best and the worst light.
So one of the shark stories that stands out is a young man, 19 years old, named L.D. Cox. And he saw a man next to him get snatched by a shark. And it was so close that the attack caused a wave to break over him, just like he was at the beach. And when he looked, his friend was gone. A second attack that's very vivid to me was a man named Eugene Morgan. He was looking at one of the floater nets that Sarah mentioned, and there were about a dozen men on the floater net. And all of a sudden, it was attacked by something like 10 or 15 sharks. And it was a frenzy of froth and foam and fins. And then within less than a minute, the entire net and all the men on it were gone.
Mm. It is just harrowing. And after days at sea, many of them were burned when they got on. Some of those survived, but sunburned, tongues swollen with dehydration, and they really began losing their minds. Sarah, you referred to some of the depravity, but how did they describe it?
These men were doing whatever they could for the greater good. And these were their brothers. And these decisions were not taken lightly. I mean, it affected the men who teamed together. And, you know, to take a step back and give you a little bit more on that story, you know, their men had lost their minds by this point. They were totally hallucinating and their, you know, brains swelling, their drinking salt water, they're close to death, and they're just taking out people around them. A lot of it is because, remember, they're covered in oil and they're confused. So they're now thinking these are Japanese people attacking them. So they're trying to fight back. They're not in their right mind. And, you know, these men that are hallucinating are taking out men that are healthy or as healthy as you can be at that point in the water. And so the group of individuals who decided to team up and say, if anyone starts attacking anyone else, we'll take them out first. They agonized over this decision and it affected them the rest of their lives. I mean, you know, two of them took their own lives not long after surviving. And so it was something that was done for the greater good, but at even the cost of part of, I think, their souls, because it was just so devastating to have to do that to a shipmate that you thought so highly of.
I just found myself screaming, why did no one at Sinkpack know that Indy had been sunk? Why?
It's a multitude of reasons. And sadly, one of the biggest reasons was complacency. As I mentioned before, the southern part of the Pacific, the South Pacific, Philippine Sea, was considered safe. At least it was considered safe by those who weren't paying attention. Those who were paying attention did know that there was an enemy submarine threat, a Japanese submarine threat, but that information was kept, paradoxically, on the highest levels, the highest levels of classification. So in addition to complacency, what you had was a failure to communicate. So you had a failure to communicate the submarine threat on the western half of the Philippine Sea with the commanders on the eastern half at Guam. And those people failed to communicate a threat to Captain McVeigh. And in addition to that, it was later considered a failure that there was no escort sent. So in addition to those lacks of communication, as Sarah mentioned, all the communications were out aboard Indianapolis. So even though there were heroic radio men in the radio rooms trying to send out distress signals. Those distress signals did not reach shore. And then, in addition to complacency and a lack of communication, there was also incompetence. There was a lieutenant named Stuart Gibson who was in the arrivals office in the Philippines, and he had received a message that said not to report the arrival of combatant ships. The reason for that instruction was to cut down on routine message traffic. And he thought to himself, well, gee, if I'm not supposed to report the arrival of combatant ships, I guess I'm not supposed to report the non-arrival of combatant ships. Mm. And he was later disciplined for that, although it was a slap on the wrist compared to what happened to Captain McVeigh.
Right. We'll definitely want to know more about that. But first, let's get to the beautiful part that they were indeed saved. Nearly 600 men died in those 5 days, it sounds like. They were discovered 5 days later, almost by chance. So what happened there?
Actually, the rescue part of the story is really one of our favorite parts of the story. Lieutenant Gwynn was flying routine patrol, and he was testing out a new antenna, and the antenna had broke off, and so he had gone back to check it out, and when he opened up the doors and he looked down, he saw an oil slick. And, you know, they're way, way up. There's no way they could see people in the water at this point, but he saw the oil slick and he thought it was a submarine. And so he, you know, orders his co-pilot to dive down. They're going to open the bomb bay doors. And just as they're opening the bomb bay doors, they look and they see heads in the water. And we don't know who this is. You know, we don't know if it's enemy. We don't know if it's our own. There's no reports of major losses. And so he doesn't know what's going on. He calls it in, ducks on the pond, and he starts circling and he's seeing more and more men in the water. And they're spread out over something like 25 miles at this point because, you know, the ones on the rafts had drifted further than the men in the water that were swimming. And so they're spread out in different groups. They're not even aware of each other. You know, the survivors at this point don't even know that there are others in the water other than the ones close to them. And so Chuck Gwynn spots these men, calls it in, and all of a sudden, you know, other pilots start arriving. And I think Lynn really wants to tell you the Adrian Marc story, so I'm going to toss the baton over to her on this.
The reason I really want to tell you the Adrian Marc story is because when I was in the Navy, I was in the aviation community. And this man, Adrian Marc, was the pilot of a Catalina, which is a seaplane. And I think he is just one of the absolute heroes of this story. Adrian Marc is one of the pilots that flies up in response to Lieutenant Gwynn's distress sighting message. And once he is there, he is just astonished at the scope of the disaster that he can see unfurling underneath them. He sees hundreds of men in the water. And by this time, Lieutenant Gwynn, another aircraft that had come to the scene, and Marc's own crew had kicked out all the rescue gear that they had. So they had, you know, water casks, and they had rafts, and they had portable radios that they hoped that they could dump into the water and that people would understand how to use them. But now the sun is going down, and everyone knows, all the aviators know, that no rescue ships will arrive in the area for at least 12 hours. Well, it's against regulations and against policy for Marc to land his seaplane in the open sea. The swells are 12 feet high. A seaplane can land in the sea. That's its purpose. But it's supposed to be like in a smoother area. And so that's why those landings in the open sea were both dangerous and forbidden. And as Marc is looking down and considering that, his crew looks down and they can see men still being taken by sharks. Mm. And he decides, you know what? The rules be damned. I'm in a position to save some of these men, and I'm going to make an open sea landing. And so he lands that plane successfully in the water, and he starts to water taxi around, and they're able to crowd 53 survivors onto his plane while they're waiting for the actual surface ships to show up.
We are learning this hour about the terrible end of the Indianapolis. It was the worst naval disaster in U.S. history, with Sarah Vladeck, who's become an authority on the Navy cruiser. She's made a documentary film about it and is now co-writer of the book Indianapolis with Lynn Vincent, a former investigative journalist and a Navy veteran. The wreckage was discovered in 2017. This was 72 years after it was sunk by the Japanese, just weeks before surrender. There are many stories of heroism here and survival, along with retribution for commanding officer Captain Charles McVeigh, who was court-martialed. What happened?
So the Navy went through a process of looking at what they could charge Captain McVeigh with. And what that came down to was the failure to call abandoned ship, which they very quickly proved that he did. There was multiple testimonies given during the court of inquiry and in the court-martial showing that he gave the order and that it was passed verbally from sailor to sailor. And then the second charge they brought up against him was failure to zigzag. And what zigzagging was a maneuver used at that time to evade Japanese or enemy submarine torpedoes. Well, by that point in the war, this was common practice. The Japanese actually factored this into their maneuvers so that they would, you know, accommodate for the zigzagging. In fact, Hashimoto had even planned with that in mind. And so during this court-martial, what happened is they bring in, you know, for the first time ever, they bring in the enemy to testify against Captain McVeigh. You know, this was not done prior to this. Actually, a captain had never been brought in for court-martial for the loss of a vessel during wartime prior to this either. So, you know, this was all something set up to point a finger because you had 879 families who wanted someone to blame. And this was very much in the press. It was, you know, national news, what was going on with this court-martial. And they bring in Commander Hashimoto to testify against Captain McVeigh. And what Hashimoto said through a translator was that he would have sunk the ship no matter what. But that's not what the translator conveyed. And Hashimoto, not speaking English, he understood, but he couldn't convey properly that that's not what he said. And so the failure to zigzag was really kind of a bogus charge because it wouldn't have mattered. He would have been able to sunk the ship no matter what.
And an accelerated trial to get him to court-martial. Mm-hmm. What did happen to him?
Captain McVeigh, first of all, after his conviction, which ruined his career, he was sent to a staff job. He would never again be in command, and he retired in 1949, 4 years after his court-martial. And then he went into insurance, and it was very sad, you know, because he was the commander of this proud flagship and had a distinguished career prior to taking command of Indianapolis. And instead of staying, you know, in touch with his fellow officers and joining fraternities as men did at that time when they were retired, he just faded into the background. And the saddest thing was is that not all of the Indianapolis families blamed Captain McVeigh for the loss of their sons and brothers and husbands, but many did. And the fact that they did was directly attributable to the fact that the Navy said it was his fault. They convicted him. And so for many, many years after the court-martial, Captain McVeigh would receive these terrible letters from families of the lost that said things like, if it wasn't for you, I'd be celebrating Christmas with my husband right now, or if it wasn't for you, my girls would have a father. And these letters seemed penned in acid, and they came on birthdays of the lost, on the anniversary of the sinking, and they never stopped. And for many, many years, he received them. In 1960, the Indianapolis survivors held their first reunion, and Captain McVeigh was invited as the keynote speaker. And one of the wonderful parts of the story we find is that the men still supported him after all those years. However, the letters never stopped coming, and in 1968, it became too much, and Captain McVeigh committed suicide.
It was just one tragedy on top of several others in this story. But for you, those survivors, those who first started meeting in 1960 at a reunion, Sarah, you said 17 years with these people, and for both of you, a race against the clock, really, to talk with these survivors. How many are alive now?
Absolutely. I mean, when I started, there were 117 survivors alive, and now there are 14 still living. And the youngest is going to be 92.
Oh.
So, you know, you're right. It's coming to an end. And every time it's like losing a grandpa. So, you know, it's been such a treasure and such a blessing to get to share their lives, you know, parts of their lives with them and their families and become so close to them. But it's also really, really hard to go to 117 memorial services.
Yeah. I'm so sorry, but, you know, I'm wondering about how they feel about their story now being told. Lynn, you're a Navy veteran. What does it mean for you to see these men and really their families suddenly have this story exposed?
Well, I'm welling up a little bit as you ask that question because there are, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands and millions, if you look back through history, of men and, of course, more recently, women who have done this heroic service. And it's a very quiet heroism. There's not a lot of fanfare. You know, most people who serve in the military, they don't get a parade when they come home. And so to be able to tell these stories, just the ordinary story of the ordinary sailor or the ordinary officer, to just show how they were able to serve their country and many of them to make the ultimate sacrifice is just so meaningful to me and to the larger military community. It's been a real honor.
Well, I am so grateful that you shared this story with us. And I want to let listeners know that, you know, this is a deep story, but there's so much more. There is, as you say in the title, the fight to exonerate an innocent man. And there's this whole relationship and after story with Hashimoto that is just fascinating. So I will leave that to them as I thank you so much, Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent, for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent will be at the upcoming Savannah Book Festival to talk about their book, Indianapolis. And we'll have a crew there from On Second Thought as well. Hope to see you there. And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.